Welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, a weekly podcast from Hobeck Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, mystery, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of running a creative business in this challenging world. We'll hear from the people who make this possible, the authors, the cover designers and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on the Hobcast Book Show from Hobeck Books, as we combine trad values and an indie spirit.
And welcome to the Hobcast Book Show. It is show number 110.
110.
It is, and we are nestled in a wonderful cafe that we've visited four times this week in Rye in East Sussex.
Called the Apothecary.
The Apothecary.
That's it.
It is. It's very characterful, and Rye has been fantastic. We've been here for a week. This has been our week break.
It's our last day.
This is our last full day here, and There's a tinge of sadness, but we ought to introduce ourselves properly. We can't assume that everyone's coming to us and knows who we are. So my name's Adrian Hobart.
My name's Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hobeck Books, UK independent publishers of the following four genres.
Crime.
Suspense.
Mysteries.
And thrillers.
There was a pause.
There's always a pause. I ought to express that I've not been that well this week. Number of issues. Poorly teeth, as usual. I just attract bad teeth. They are a disaster zone.
You make it sound like they come and stick themselves, do
yeah,
you?
Yeah, it does feel that way. That was the start. Then there was a cold.
And I gave you.
And last night, I had food that disagreed with me. And I just been in the wars all week, it feels like.
Yes, every part of you that could fall off and go wrong has fallen off and gone wrong.
Yeah, okay. I've still got limbs.
And elbows are working, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that's good. But anyway, look, welcome to the show. And as ever, we have a wonderful guest. And it's Susan Darlington, who, this is a departure for us. We've not really done poetry.
We haven't.
On the Hobcast Book Show. But that's where we're going today.
It is. Yes, and I think we'll do more poetry in the future because we enjoyed our poetry corner.
We did. So Susan Darlington, she's based in Leeds and she is a fabulous poet. We will hear two poems from her, but we also have up our sleeves a little bonus a little later in the show. We'll say no more.
Not literally up our sleeves, because that would be uncomfortable.
Well, my elbows just can't take the pressure of anything being up my sleeves, so...
Yeah, we don't want to break your elbows.
No,
we just sat there working.
No, I need those to be able to drive home ready for another busy week ahead at Hobeck Towers. But let's get into, well, I think there is just the one news story for us this week. And actually it broke, as we recorded last week, the story of Roald Dahl and the rewrites.
Mm.
That the rights holders for the Roald Dahl estate and the books, well, they're published by Puffin, which is an offshoot
part of
Penguin Random House. And overall, they are owned by Netflix now. And they were bought out a couple of years ago. But they have decided to pass the books through. And don't... I mean, if you haven't read a Roald Dahl book, who hasn't, frankly, at you know, any point in life, you'll know that there's some language there which is, you know, it's done for... It's colourful. It's powerful. It's, you know, it's... They're just wonderful character descriptions that grab children's attention and minds and have done for the last 40, 50 years.
So what he did very effectively, I think, is he pushed the boundaries of reality.
Yes.
So there's that supernatural element, but they're not completely supernatural. So children can relate to them, looking at the people around them, relate to the characters.
And thematically, they're largely about exposing the frailties and the vices of adult humans, and indeed kids as well, to some extent, so something like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And at the end, our hero, who is usually a good soul, you know, caring soul, will prevail.
Yes, but I think he sort of made children think that they had the slight upper hand in terms of intelligence and wisdom on adults, which I loved as a child.
Absolutely, and isn't that wonderful? The fridge that has been rattling around in the background, we also mentioned that we're in this cafe, as I say, but the fridge is rather noisy. Compressor has relented for just a little bit of time, so it's going to sound a lot better. Good work. But no, I think that's it. It gave children agency, a feeling that...
Yeah, you know, exactly.
Sometimes in combination with adults, like Danny the Champion of the World, which is one of my favourite books, you know, he and his dad defeating the avaricious landowners around with you know, drugging the pheasants and all that sort of thing, saving the pheasants from the guns. It's just brilliant.
And what I like about his books is that he accepted that not all children have a perfect, happy life.
No.
And so it helped those children, I think, to feel better about their own lives in a way.
Well, look at Charlie. I mean,
in extreme
poverty. With his grandparents top and tailing the one bed in their house, in their shack, and inheriting the... I don't want to give spoilers, but, you know, the chocolate factory at the end of it. So this is...
I don't know if you can give spoilers on the chocolate factory.
What we haven't expressed is what the story is. So basically, the owners of the books have decided that they were going to rewrite them to take out the stuff that they felt was dodgy. And they put it through the sensitivity reading prism, which is an all too prevalent, in my view, prevalent part of publishing now, where things are just basically being handed over. So someone's creative art, their decision making, the point of view they're trying to take is now being basically edited out by people they've never met before. Anthony Horowitz has talked about this. We've talked about this on the podcast extensively, where a story that a novel that he rewrote recently was so changed that he just didn't want to be associated with it. He was so disgusted by what had happened. But this is what's happened to Roald Dahl. So let's have a look at some of the examples. I will just draw it up now. Roald Dahl was somebody who had... Let's not divorce the fact that he had views which in any time period would appall people, particularly anti-Semitic views, and his relationship with women was an interesting one.
I'm sure he'd say so, yeah.
But I think these books are brilliant. Anyway, they had decided that these books needed to change. Let me find some examples. Here we are. Some characters are not allowed to be fat anymore. In fact, all of them are not allowed to be fat. In Matilda, Miss Trunchbull's great horsey face becomes simply her face. But in other cases, the rewriting is just bizarre. Take the use of colour. Characters turn quite pale and not white anymore. In Fantastic Mr. Fox, a description of a pair of tractors as both black has been cut. Contemporary authors know all too well about the power wielded by sensitivity readers. The concerns of younger activist employees at publishing houses too often end up moulding the final edit. Yeah, I believe that. But rewriting the works of long-dead authors is surely worse, it says here in the Telegraph. Well, they would take that sort of attitude. Anyway, this story has moved on. This has caused an enormous debate.
I think it's partly because when you're rewriting the words of somebody who can't answer back, that people get very upset by that.
Well, he used to say, he said to, let me see, who was it? It was Lucian Freud, I think. No, Francis Bacon, I'm sorry. He had a conversation with Francis Bacon many, many years ago, and he said that if my publishers change even a comma in my manuscripts, I will send the great big hungry crocodile to eat them. He was very, very particular about...
Watch out, Puffin.
Exactly.
Netflix.
Yeah, and he felt very particular about this, and, you know, I can understand that. Now, listen, we've had to, in the Hoback context, talk to our authors sometimes about subjects where or approaches to certain things which we felt didn't sit well with a modern audience. That's not the same as putting it through, refracted through a sensitivity reader. So the debate then widened out. Salman Rushdie got involved. The Queen Consort, Camilla, spoke out about it. She just launched a book charity this week, her own book charity. She's read Roald Dahl on Jack and Nori on the BBC.
Has she?
Yeah.
I used to love Jack and Nori.
She loves Roald Dahl, so she stepped into the debate. The Dutch and French publishers of Roald Dahl's books refused to make the changes and fall into line with the rest of the English versions.
All right, okay.
And so
didn't
now,
know that.
Under this furore, Puffin and Penguin have tried to justify it, but now they are going to publish a classic version.
Yeah.
And this new doctored
okay,
version.
That, that's
version.
A happy compromise, I guess, between the two positions. But
well, yes and no, because I'm going to say they should never have meddled with it in the first place. And I do think that children can make, you know, I don't think it's overly influential. You know, Augustus Gloop is now enormous and not fat. Fine. But it, to my way of thinking, we should credit children with a lot more judicious sense.
Yeah, than, we've had this discussion about Doctor Who, haven't we?
Yes, we
the
have.
Way that they sort of force a moral message through Doctor Who. And my boys have said, we don't want that. We want to be entertained. We don't want to be told that it's what's right and wrong. And
Doctor Who, in the last three seasons or so, has been exceptionally preachy. There's always been elements of that, but it's been a lot subtler.
Yes.
You know, going back to the 70s, John Pertwee era was all about environmental stories and about, because it was based on Earth. He couldn't travel in the TARDIS. It was partly to save money, then he had to build alien sets. But basically, a lot of the stories of that era were about the threat of, you know, the oil industry and things like that. And then latterly, you've got something like Terror of the Zygons, where there's a monster destroying North Sea oil rigs. So it was always contemporary.
But those stories make you go away and think about it, whereas the more modern stories were just telling you, this is what we want you to think.
Exactly.
So it's different.
So this has been a very interesting debate. And I read this morning that the next to get this treatment is Ian Fleming and the James Bond books.
It'll just go on, though, won't it?
Yeah, it will. It will. But in my opinion, it's got to stop. You know, I think doctoring stuff, because it's from a different period, to bring it up to modern mores, it's just one step off of burning the books, in my view. You know, we should allow audiences to access whatever they want. If they feel strongly about the sort of thing and the mores of books written in the 1960s, the 1950s, whatever, then they don't read them. Same as switching the telly off if something appalls you. In my view. And to go in and deliberately make them less offensive to a modern audience, just wrong, because that was not the author's intention, or indeed the rest of the people involved in that creative process.
Yeah, because people have enough intelligence to know it's in the context of history, context of different times and different culture. But
absolutely.
They need to be given that.
We'd love
choice.
To know your views. Please contact us at Hobeck Books if you want to enter this debate or join us on the social media.
But we're not Angry Person Radio, are we?
No, we're not. No, we're not. No. I just think it's been a fascinating debate and an unfortunate one, and completely unnecessary in many ways. But anyway, it's out there now. Okay, let's get to, because I said we're only going to do the one big news item this week.
Yeah, because it's such a big news item.
It is. Let's get to our interview with Susan Darlington. And, it is a departure for us to touch on poetry, but what comes from this interview is the power of the word and the amount of work it takes to convey such powerful themes and ideas in so few words.
Well, I think, to me, what I got out of it is that she was conveying the same amount of emotion through the fewer words than somebody who would do the same amount of motion in, like, a story or a book, but poetry can do that.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that, well, it's something that we ask her, actually. Have you ever thought about doing long-form writing in terms of writing novels? Because she's also a reviewer of the arts, and that's really was a gateway into writing poetry and getting it published. Had that ever appealed to her? And she's actually, no, she's comfortable in the shorter forms, but nonetheless, I do think... forgive me.
Keep talking.
He's coughing a lot. It's my fault. Because I gave it to him, sorry.
Yeah.
Now we're going.
I think that there's a lot to be said for improving your prose by trying some poetry. In terms of, you know, cadence, rhythm, the beauty of the language.
And the fact that every word... earns its place in a poem.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk to Susan Darlington.
It's so lovely to be joined by Susan Darlington. Thank you so much for joining us on the Hopcast Book Show.
Good to be here. Pleased to meet you.
You too. And I wanted to ask, I mean, I normally don't go into these interviews with any prepared questions, but I had one already.
I know what it is.
So this is my random question. No, not at all. When did you first fall in love with the word, as in the power of words?
Yeah, words.
It's probably a bit of a cliche, but I think I always have been in love with the word. I think I grew up in a household where I was fortunate enough to have stories read to me, you know, before going to bed. And you know, having those Ladybird books, which I would ask to be read on repeat until I could remember every single word from them. And it never really went away. You know, I think the books I read kind of developed, obviously. But yeah, that the escapism that you can get from a book, you know, I think I have always needed it in life. So yeah, just always. The only thing that's ever challenged it really is music.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I totally believe it. I mean, it's funny enough because am I right in saying you're in Leeds at the moment?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, that's where my eldest is at university.
But the reason I mention it is because last night's episode of The Piano was on Leeds Station on Channel 4, which was one of the most moving things I've ever watched, with this young lady called Lucy, who's been blind pretty much from birth, playing Chopin's Nocturne Number 1 and just doing it beautifully, but unable to see the keys, just does it by feeling.
Oh, it's incredible, wasn't it? She also
yeah, and so yeah, absolutely, she's got many developmental issues, but the thing was that what you're saying about the word and also music combined, you know, in terms of the two things that can move you in that fashion, absolutely chimes with me, because I was absolutely sobbing my eyes out last night. It was terrible.
We've seen two episodes now. There's only been two episodes, haven't there?
I told you this interview would be random, but there we go. We've gone off on a tangent. But in terms of your own writing life, what stage did that take? Was it always through school? Did you, you know, was it the thing you looked forward to most?
Yeah. I mean, I think English was always one of those subjects where I almost didn't need to try at it because I had that genuine interest. So I was probably doing it anyway. You know, I was reading through choice. I always remember, you know, writing little stories, you know, about squirrels and, you know, hedgehogs, all the usual stuff. Yeah, and that was kind of helping me develop. And then I think when I got to be a teenager, the creative side perhaps dropped off. But I then started to really get that passion for music. And so I started to write reviews and interviews with musicians. So in some shape or form, that writing has always been there, whether or not it's been part of kind of school curriculum or going on. I mean, I studied English at university, so it's always been there in some shape.
I was going to say, because you were talking about writing reviews and interviewing musicians, but I think there's a creativity in non-fiction writing just as much as creative writing, isn't there? You know,
I think it depends on the outlet, if you like. Now, you're writing still, you're doing a lot of this creative writing journalism, reviewing music and art and the written word. So, and it really depends on what, you know, publication you're going for, doesn't it? In terms of how creative you can be and how much trust they place in you to you know, and allow you to go. Is that your experience?
Yeah. I think as well is that the trend in print to go towards shorter and shorter reviews because we've got a shorter and shorter attention span, or that's what we're told. Conversely, you've probably got a lot of websites where there really is no word count because obviously you're not taking any page count. And from a creative point of view and a pleasurable point of view, in some ways those are far more satisfying. You know, obviously 200 words is quite challenging to say why you like something, but it's still an opportunity to share that enthusiasm. You've got 500, 1,000 words and you can really go for it. You can do your research, you can go off on how it moves you. It's not just pure explanation, it's about feeling as well. And I think those are the ones which probably I respond to as a reader. And so as a writer, that's what I try to achieve. Not always successfully, certainly within deadlines and timeframes, but yeah, that's the goal.
Are you one of those people who likes to work to a deadline? I mean, you actually find it the flow comes because of the pressure. I mean, I'm certainly one of those people, but I don't know about you.
To a point, yeah. I mean, I think it can be useful in terms of having an end point. You know, I think we all know, don't we, that you can tinker endlessly with a piece of work, you know, putting in those commas, taking out the comma, changing B to yet to A. So having the deadline can be really useful. I guess conversely, sometimes I would certainly like to research a piece more than I have the time for. But there's probably a healthy balance between the two.
You're definitely a deadline person, aren't you?
Oh, yes. I mean, to an absolutely anarchic degree. I have to say that, you know, if I can leave it and leave it and leave it, I will. And it drives you nuts, doesn't it? I mean from a business point of view, it's not not a great way to run.
I've learned how to manage you now that, yeah. I won't bother if it's 2 weeks, I won't bother saying, can you do this, because he won't. But yeah. If I say, oh, it's, you know, ideally by 1 o'clock, can you do this, and he'll do it.
Yeah
It's also a skill, isn't it? It's knowing how we work, but it's also knowing how other people work, so that we can get the best from ourselves and other people. So
that's true. I mean, it is, and I mean, it's always been that way. Essay crises at university, I think I discussed this last week, were monumental. I was going to ask the question, actually, when you said you studied English at university, quite often, and I had a few friends who did, and I did consider it at one stage. Excuse me, sorry, I've just dropped my phone. I noticed that some of the pleasure of the English language actually left people when they went and studied at university. I don't know if that echoes with you at all.
I don't know if the enjoyment did, but certainly it made me view things in a different way.
Yeah.
Which I guess to a point is the purpose of studying. It made me really consider themes, repeated words, which, yeah, certainly gave it a more critical angle, which detracted from some of the flow. But I think, thinking about it now, some of those things probably helped with my writing, because, you know, having themes or having continuity through a piece, especially poetry, which is very short and condensed, I think those are really important things. And maybe I would have learned them anyway by being a reader, but having been forced into that critical thinking at university definitely helped, I think.
I've got to ask, did you get, I mean, for everybody I always knew who studied English got stuck with Beowulf for absolutely for months on end, it seemed. I don't know if that's how your course went.
I didn't, no. I mean, I have subsequently read Beowulf, which I did really enjoy.
Yeah.
I think the worst one we had was we had Ulysses to read in a fortnight.
Oh, my
God. Oh, no.
Of course, absolutely no one achieved. I think I read the first three chapters and just gave up on it. And I've never gone back to it, to my shame.
I have a confession on that book. So it's one of those books that you're supposed to have read. Mm-hmm. If you consider yourself well-read, that's one of the books you're supposed to have read and be able to talk about it and marvel at its, you know.
Yeah, genius, sort
of.
Yeah.
And I did give up. I was on a train and I got about three chapters in and I thought, I don't get it. And I just left it on the train.
You actually left the book on the train?
Yeah.
Good Lord.
I thought someone else might enjoy it.
They may very well.
I mean, I'm sure it is a work of genius, but I couldn't. My imagination didn't relate to it at all.
Yeah. Let's turn to the poetry then, because that's your principal sort of literary outlet at the moment. And What drew you to concentrating on poetry? Because for a lot of people, it's quite an intimidating thing to approach, really, I think.
I'm honestly not too sure, in a way. I mean, as I say, when I was growing up, I predominantly wrote short stories. And then at some point, I'm not too sure when or why, it pivoted more towards poetry. I suspect it was kind of a time factor, though. I think it's probably a lie that poetry is easier or quicker to write than a short story, because in some ways, there's probably a lot more editing and concision that goes into it. I suppose like a lot of teenagers, you know, I was introduced to people like Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton. And certainly when I was growing up, Riot Girl was kind of quite a big musical or youth culture, where those two writers were very much at the forefront.
Yeah.
That was something that I was reading a lot about at the time. I kind of got swept up in by the whole enthusiasm of it and the can-do attitude of it, which again, I think helped me, given that even though I did study English at university, I still feel like in many ways I'm untutored in writing creatively.
Mm. Shall we hear one of your poems?
Yes.
I know we've asked you to have a couple. Well, let's hear one and then we can take it from there, if that's all right.
Okay, yeah. I'll read one which is from my current book, which is called Never Wear White. And I'll read a piece which was loosely inspired by a news story, which you may or may not remember. There was a prawn fisherman who was swallowed by a whale.
Right,
and then
yes.
Was spat out by him, which I just thought was such a fantastic story. You know,
yeah, I did read that one. Yeah.
All over again. So this is very, very loosely inspired by that incident. It's called The Encounter. The whale swallowed my mother when she was just a child. She was floating in a raft when everything went black. Calmly counted to 40 before she was spat back out. The encounter improved her swimming. Teachers said she was a natural, and her bedroom walls became lined with trophies. She never ate fish again, swore it would bring bad luck. She adorned her clothes with tiny silver air bubbles that burst under my cheek when she held me close and told me her life story. I didn't quite believe her, yet every time she had a bath, I pressed my ear to the door and listened to her siren's call. She would lull me to sleep. When I woke, she'd have cleaned the seaweed tide mark from the tub.
Wonderful.
Yeah, that's great. And I think that my first impression is that it tells a story. So do you write poetry? Is most of your poetry telling a story of some sort, as opposed to, you know, like you have poems who they're very much emotion based, or do you know what I mean? Or
yeah, I mean,
well, there was narrative.
But with layers, yeah.
Yeah, I think they quite possibly do have a tendency towards, or certainly latterly, have a tendency towards the narrative, which I suppose links quite neatly back to what we were saying before about short stories.
Mm.
In some ways, I think, oh, could this be flash fiction? But it never quite expands that far. It always remains in quite a tight poetic form.
Mm.
But that's interesting, isn't it? Because the division between poetry and flash fiction. Because flash fiction doesn't necessarily have to be straight text, does it? It can have a form to it, I think. But it's not quite poetry.
Yeah, I'm not. To be honest, because we're so in the publishing crime fiction kind of world at the moment, I haven't, you know, my sort of Catholic tastes have sort of narrowed somewhat to essentially looking at prose, you know, and books as opposed to flash fiction, poetry, or anything else at the moment. And part of me sort of really sort of yearns to get connected again with those forms. But, you know, it's a question of time, really.
Mm.
But I was interested. I mean, have you ever been tempted to write novels?
Yes. I'm pausing because I say yes, but I know we're all meant to have a novel inside us. I've never had that one big story that I've wanted to tell.
Mm.
I do tend to, you know, saying that the poem that I just read has got a narrative to it. But when I sit down and think, okay, how can I turn that into even a short story, let alone a novel? I kind of think, oh, I've got no idea, really.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm so used to writing in a very short, tight form. That it's a challenge to not I don't want to go into the purple prose quite, but to be more florid even I find challenging.
Right.
Maybe that's a challenge that I should set myself.
Yeah.
It could be, but
I can relate to that because I've actually had poems published once in a book.
Have you?
Yes, you know about this, don't you?
Yeah.
So
yes, I remember.
I'll show you a copy later. So where I used to live in Charlbury in Oxfordshire, and they had a bookshop, and the owner of the bookshop put out that he wanted poetry about the area. He was going to publish a book. So I wrote some poems and they got published. That was my poetry career. But I personally prefer writing short stories or flash fiction. I can't, the thought of writing a novel is really daunting. I did try during lockdown, like many people did, but didn't get very far.
You see, this is where I have a sort of untried thesis, really. But I think from your perspective, you know, as a recognized and increasingly celebrated poet, right? Your command of that form of language could actually very well inform and strengthen, if you did get to the sort of longer forms thing, that command of the structure, of, you know, the way that you put a poem together, the cadence, the rhythm. It could be a great asset, because I think a lot of writers can do the prosaic, but finding that extra element of truth and magic in the way that people talk to each other, particularly in dialogue, in the way that you've condensed a very, you know, in a fantastical setting, a very human set of thoughts, you know, a theme that has a real resonance. That's often lacking, I think, from fiction, unless it's in the literary side of it. And then sometimes, as you say, the purple prose comes out and it, you know, you start losing yourself. But actually, writing in a poetic way can be quite direct as well. Yeah. You know, you can convey. And actually, I think that I would like to read more dialogue in this, you know, in the commercial side of things, which had that element of cadence and also an element of mystery to it. That, you know, it's the negative space, the things they're not saying are the things that convey. I don't know if I'm making myself
clear. No, I do know what you mean. Because when somebody who is a poet turns to writing, you can tell, because they know the value of each individual word, and they don't go over the top and like you're talking about writing.
More comfortable leaving stuff out.
Prosaic, yeah. So there may be a sentence where there's more said in that sentence because of what, like you say, what's not said in the sentence. And then I think people experience with poetry or have a poetic way of looking at the world are very good at that element, at that aspect of writing.
Yeah, I suppose it's notable how many poets, people start out as poets and then they seem to move into novels. I think, you know, you've got people like Helen Mort, obviously you've got Sylvia Plath. I'm struggling to think of people who've done the reverse, who've started out as a novelist and gone on to do poems. I mean, I suppose you've got people like Margaret Atwood, haven't you, who's always shifted
between. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And
Larkin wrote a couple of books as well.
Right, and then you think of someone who is the master of prose in the non-fiction sense in Clive James, who was a wonderful poet. And it's in, you know, in those latter years as he became ill, and he wrote about his illness and stuff like that. And also I think he did some translations as well of other works. He's, you know, his poetry became, once he got off the telly, if you like, everyone started to recognize his true literary talent. And poetry was his first passion and love. But he managed, in the Observer columns he used to write about television, and indeed the way he put scripts together for television, just a master of the written word. There's somebody I you know, I've got a caricature of him on my desk, but he, you know, a true hero of mine, I think. to have those two things, to be exceptionally funny and able to communicate in an intelligent way to the whole, you know, British audience, at the same time as being incredibly high level poet as well.
Yeah, I think it's an incredible skill, isn't it? Just in writing, whether it's poetry, short stories, it should all be about communication, shouldn't it? And to me, while there's certainly scope for experimental writing, to me it's about being accessible. I don't like things which are particularly elitist. you know, I want to reach people, I want to make them feel. And someone like Clive James was, yeah, as you say, he was a master at doing it and making people feel relaxed. Oh, that's the impression we get from watching footage of him and reading interviews with him. And that, yeah, it's a genuine skill, which to then be able to turn that into other forms. Yeah, people who can do multiple things is just something that I'm incredibly jealous of. Yeah, but no, also admire. You know, I guess that's a better way of phrasing it.
Absolutely. These polymaths are just crazy, aren't they? In terms of the way that your poetry has developed, I read that you're regularly out performing around the West Yorkshire area. How much does an audience reaction pay back into your work in terms of does it deflect you in different directions? Does the feedback you get from an audience change the way that you approach your work? Or indeed, you know, would you still be writing if you didn't have that audience, if you like, you know, that face-to-face interaction with people?
I think I would always be writing. You know, I think it's something which is just, as with many people who write or play music or something, I think it's an internal drive. When I don't have that outlet, because I feel a bit incomplete, you know, like something's missing within me. I try not to be too influenced by what people say, in that I want to be able to hopefully continue to develop my writing in a way that challenges me as much as an audience. But that said, of course, it's incredibly flattering when someone comes up to me after a reading and says, "No, I like that poem. I can really relate to that poem." Or, you know, it triggered certain emotions within them, or it triggered a debate. You know, I think that's the highest praise that anyone can have, really, to move someone.
Absolutely, yeah. In terms of the culture around you at the moment in Leeds and Yorkshire, I get the impression there's a really strong poetry scene. Is that, am I right in thinking that?
Yeah. I mean, we've got quite a lot of open mic nights. Obviously, we've got Simon Armitage, who's going to be working on the Poetry Centre, which is going to be in Leeds. In the wider sense, you know, we've got Leeds 2023. We've got Bradford as the City of Culture 2025. Wakefield, Kirklees, they've all got their Years of Culture coming up. So as a region, it feels like it's really thriving in that widest sense, not just in poetry. But yeah, it just feels like suddenly all these things are being recognised and celebrated. And it's really community-based. There's so much community outreach going on to encourage everybody and make them believe that they do have that creative spirit within them, that they can do it, which, you know, I think is so encouraging, you know, coming from a time when it didn't feel like there was that much.
I was going to say, because of all that effort that's gone in by yourself and others around you, and now suddenly, you know, it's a thing that everyone is recognizing, and it's getting that opportunity to shine. But it must have felt at times like a, you know, lonely and difficult struggle, you know, at the times when this wasn't recognized. Now it's everyone's behind it, but you know, it's not always been that way.
I don't know. I think when I was growing up, there was a very lively sort of fanzine culture, which, yes, it was primarily around music, but there was a scope there for literature. So I might not have known people in my hometown or people actually in person, but I feel like there was always a vibrant scene out there through letters, because this was pre-email. And it was always a supportive community, so I've never really felt isolated in that way. I just think we now have obviously different modes of communication with website and email, and yeah, obviously big scale events like this, which have perhaps made it easier to connect on a smaller scale. But yeah, people have always been creative, and they've always sought out other creatives. I don't think that's ever going to change.
I hope not.
Do you think, because Yorkshire, I was just thinking about Yorkshire, because a lot of our authors are from Yorkshire, like more bigger proportion are from Yorkshire than should be.
It's like the thing they were saying in London 2012, you know, Yorkshire is like number 10 on the medal table.
Yeah.
at the Olympics.
You know, you could say, is it because of the landscape that people are inspired by the landscape to write, or they feel they have the space to write and be creative. Do you find the landscape of where you are, does that inspire your work?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, I'm fortunate in that I'm in North Leeds, so I don't have too far to travel before I'm in the countryside. And I've also got areas to walk within like 10, 15 minutes. And certainly being, if not being influenced directly by the environment, having the physical space to walk in and to think and to process. You know, I think walking is such a brilliant way, isn't it, to empty your mind, but empty it in a kind of a creative way where suddenly you can start to think about other things that, you know, can then feed into poems or, you know, whatever creative form we're doing.
Yeah,
I guess totally also, I suppose geographically, Yorkshire is one of the biggest counties. You know, we've got more people here than we have in all of Scotland, I think.
That's right.
I didn't know that. That's a good statistic.
So it probably statistically it makes sense that we've got a lot of writers here as well.
Yeah, that's true.
It is very true, and it is you know, there's a fabulous tradition, isn't there? You know, you're only just around the corner to the Brontes and all that sort of stuff. But it's what I was going to touch on with you were talking about the scene and you know, the way that creators will gather together and there's different forms of communication. But something I'm pining for is that feeling of, we recently been watching quite a few documentaries about the development of music in the 70s and 80s, let's say, and movements coming from geographical parts of the country. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, well, even the thing we were watching the other day about Spandau Ballet, you know, and the Blitz Club in Soho and New Romantics. But, you know, pretty much every major city in the north had something bubble up from it. And I kind of don't get that feeling anymore. Partly because it's very hard to make money out of music nowadays, unless you're a big live act. But are you sensing where you are, there is still that thing bubbling along? I mean, because there aren't the venues now for to go and do the reviews that you've done over the years.
I think we're quite fortunate in Leeds in that we, you know, we still got quite a few small supportive venues.
Yeah.
I'm thinking primarily here, you've got the Brudenell Social Club, you've got Hyde Park Book Club. So that, you know, that they are very supportive of artists. But I suppose as well, you know, that kind of the movement that you're talking about, I don't think it was always healthy, was it? It didn't always produce great art. You know, there was very much people jumping on that bandwagon.
That's true.
And so maybe, yes, we have got a far more fragmented scene now. That's not necessarily a bad thing, provided, you know, you've still got those grassroots venues to offer support, I think.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think that, you know, unfortunately, yeah, the big cities have still got enough venues to keep that thing going. But I think it's, you know, the smaller outlying places. I mean, I came from Cambridge and we had two or three venues when I was growing up. But before that, there were loads more. And you think of the biggest band that came from there was Pink Floyd. But lots of other acts of some significance came from a place like that. You don't get that now. And I kind of miss it, really. And I think it's partly the fanzine culture in terms of actually the physical copy we all used to wait for. In our case, it was a thing called Seen and Heard, which was basically edited by two blokes who used to turn up to every single gig that was ever played at this particular pub. And we'd all get a bit of, you know, even a few column, you know, 3 inches of column space was like, arrived.
He was in a band, weren't
you? Yeah. It was terrible, but yeah, I was in a band. But I kind of miss that.
I mean, there are other factors going on, aren't there? I mean, obviously a lot of venues now are being affected by things like Arts Council.
Big time.
But equally, I guess in the 80s, when you were talking about those big scenes, you know, you had people who could be on the dole.
Yeah.
And an awful lot of bands were using that dole money to support their art and their development in a way that just isn't possible now.
That's true.
I think finance is such a big factor, and increasingly it's creating those inequalities, isn't it, really, between different classes of who's able to pursue a career in the arts and who
isn't. No, that's just thing, I hadn't thought of that, but it's true, isn't it? Because most people now, they recognise they have to have a day job, which means they haven't got much time to develop their creativity or the headspace, because, you know, you come up out of work and what's the last thing you want to do is
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, it's probably your passion, but
it's still difficult.
It's a cliche, isn't it? The penniless, starving artist who becomes a megastar. But I think you're right. I think the support for grassroots arts and indeed venues has suddenly dried up, literally overnight. The last few weeks, you hear about all these theatres shutting, particularly around the north, and it's just terrible. So, does that sort of thing have an impact on your creative life, seeing things like that being put under pressure?
Well, I mean, I think like most people, I am trying to write whilst holding on a full-time day job, which is the norm these days. I mean, I don't think it probably always was. And yeah, it can be incredibly challenging to find the mental space and the energy to keep that going. I can't see that changing anytime soon, sadly. But yeah, I think I like to think that if we have that creative drive, if I have that creative drive, then somehow I will keep pushing through. It might take longer than I would like to make those developments, but I would rather it be slow and steady than not be there at all.
Yeah. Mm. Let's hear another poem, shall we? And then we'll talk about the process of getting your work out into the world. But okay. let's
the next one I'll read is talking about kind of public reactions earlier. This is probably one that's had one of the strongest responses I've had from women. It's called Carrie, which is in reference to the Stephen King novel. So again, as with the poem I read previously, it's only very, very loosely inspired by that. I learn about the shame of a woman's body from my mother's handwritten notes. The ones I pass, red-faced, to my teacher, that excuse me from showers and swimming. I stand at the edge of the echoing pool, flush under the stare of my classmates, and imagine every laugh is aimed at me, humiliated by my exclusion, and worried that while I stand here, everyone can smell the iron of my blood, see the stain seeping into my skirt's fabric and dribbling down the inside of my thighs. There's no pride in womanhood here, no sisterly bond in the changing room, where our pubescent bodies are revealed from under layers of baggy clothing, where every breast bud and roll of fat is scrutinised and found wanting, where pads and tampons are bad, but not even needing them is worse. Steeped in lessons from Carrie, we fear becoming targets of ridicule, are cruel and careless with our bodies, as we absorb a shame we don't understand.
That's very powerful. Because I do remember that feeling of when you're not doing swimming, I'm thinking everybody knows.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
It was also the memory of...
Well, no, I can't.
But I do remember.
To that degree, no.
And also that sort of fear of leaking and things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I have to say, and okay, I'm not trying to sort of belittle the issue, but when you're a teenage boy, forced into the showers, and you're 12, and half a dozen of you might have hit puberty, and the others haven't.
Well, it's the same for girls, same sort of thing.
And it's just like, I suppose. Should I say that I felt fortunate to have been one of the guys who had hit puberty? I don't know, because I think there was an element for those.
So,
the guys who were later to develop felt
absolutely so
ashamed.
My best friend,
I don't know,
who doesn't listen to this podcast, but she was quite late developing, so she didn't start her periods till she was 16, and she felt really a lot of shame for being so late developing. You know, when everyone else around her, they were changing physically and mentally and emotionally, and she hadn't gone through that yet. So,
I suppose my point is that that's very powerful, and it really speaks to that age and, the issues that girls face. And I think and that shame very often can continue through, that sense.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a different trigger later on in life.
Yeah.
Whether it be post-baby.
Oh, all sorts of things.
Whatever. Yeah. I mean, I could pick an issue, but I think that shame carries through. But it's at its perhaps rawest at that age, isn't it? When you're conscious of everything. But it's very powerful.
And I think, you know, what you just said as well, is that, that's obviously a poem from a woman's perspective.
Mm.
But you've been able to relate it to your experiences. Because I think it is an issue which in different ways affects both boys and girls. And I wouldn't want that poem just to speak in a way to one person. I like the fact that for you it kind of opened up that dialogue or that memory. And I like the fact that hopefully now we've got people who are talking a bit more openly and honestly. It feels like you've got a lot more women certainly writing TV scripts.
Yes.
And we see things like tampons on TV now, which you never did. You know, women were not allowed to have certain things happening to their bodies. So it feels like we're moving, hopefully, into a far healthier stage. And...
Well, I think so. But then something terrible happened in the sporting sphere, which is my old stomping ground in terms of journalism.
Mm.
The other day, I don't know if you saw it, Tiger Woods.
Why? What did he do?
He was playing a tournament in America. It's the first one back for several months. He's always injured and he's got bad back and his legs are knackered and all that stuff. Anyway, as a joke, he thought, his playing partner, Dustin Johnson, former world number one, he said, "You're hitting the ball like a girl." At which point, he got out of his golf bag and handed him a tampon.
Oh, dear.
In front of, you know, as they were walking between holes or whatever it was. And he couldn't recognize that he'd done something wrong. He'd now sort of been shamed into making an apology. But that was such a setback. I mean, this is somebody.
But maybe that in itself is a step forward in that. I mean, I haven't heard of that incident before you'd mentioned it.
Yeah.
But maybe even 10 years ago, that would have been seen as a joke, whereas now it's something that he has to go back and go, "Sorry, I didn't think," or
"I
was being insensitive." That's a real cultural shift, I think.
Yeah.
Well, he's an interesting character in the sense that, you know, he was, you know, to almost exclusively the only person of color on the PGA Tour. In fact, there was a joke that used to go around on the golfing circuit. I used to cover the golf a bit. And it was, what do you call 40 white men chasing one black man? And everyone expects to say Ku Klux Klan. And actually, it's the PGA Golf Tour because, you know, he was always, you know, the one up in front, and the rest of them were chasing him, if you know what I mean, in terms of
competitively. Well, he's the best one.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that was the gag. Anyway, so there's somebody who's faced a lot of racism, in fact. There was an occasion when he first won the Masters Golf Championship. What happens with the Masters winner is that they then have a champions dinner just before the next year's event, and they get to choose the menu. And one of the older players on the tour said, "Oh, we're going to have to eat, you know, grits and collard greens or something, you know, the food that he, you know," it was basically a full on racist comment.
Mm.
What do black people eat, you know, whatever. And it was, and this guy barely ever played golf again. So again, you know, for Tiger Woods to have crossed that line last week, having been the subject in another sphere of being, you know, of these sort of comments, I just, it staggers me, but there you go. Don't know where to go with that.
Well, we were going to ask you about your process of getting your poetry published. I think, weren't we? So how, you know, that started, and
again, it kind of harks back to the fanzine days, really. You know, I was buying them as a fan. I was reading them and thinking, well, you know what, I can do as well as this. And so I started to submit reviews and poems, and it kind of progressed from there, really. I started to write for more professional publications with the reviews. And I suppose at the same time, there was that transition over to the website, so you had more web journals, which made it more accessible to find out about these calls for material. It just kind of escalated through there. And I think things like Twitter, I'm not the biggest social media fan, But I think it can be, again, an incredibly useful tool for finding out about opportunities that are out there.
Yeah. And in terms of the current health of poetry, what's your take on that at the moment? Because I mean, clearly we've got Simon Armitage, we've had Andrew Motion. There's
quite a few laureate, sort of, you know, quite young poets.
Yeah, I think it seems to be getting, you know, people are getting recognition and lifted up a little earlier in their careers now. Maybe I'm wrong in that, but that's how it feels.
Yeah. I mean, I think as well, I mean, you've got the Simon Armitages of the world, but I think you've also got a really thriving sort of performance poetry scene. And again, I think it kind of almost goes back to that crossover with music, that other passion, where you've got people like Kay Tempest who straddle that area. You've got a lot of rap music, which almost seems to be going back to, I don't want to quite say its origins, but it's got much more of a spoken word element, which I think is suddenly making it a lot more attractive to some younger people who certainly at school, when all you taught is, you know, Philip Larkin and people who are old and white and male and you don't relate to it, or older people don't relate to it, suddenly having these other people who reflect your experiences and your background, then yeah, it's suddenly like, yes, I am interested in it. This is something that I can get involved in. And I do think that's feeding through into the wider scene, which is, yeah, incredibly healthy.
Yeah, it is. Well, I think at this stage we should really, you know, face our demons. This is the toughest part of the interview. Let's get to Rebecca's random question.
Okay, so you know this question because when we were driving down to Sussex, it's what, over 200 miles from?
Yeah, about 230, something like that.
And we had another hour and three quarters to go, and he said to me, I'm struggling to stay awake. Just talk to me about anything. So I thought I'll ask him a random question. So I'm going to ask you the same random question I asked him, which was, well, I was looking out the windows of the car and there were lots of trees. I said, if you were a tree, what tree would you be and why? So that's your random question.
I'm going to say something like an oak tree, because they're sort of slow and steady, aren't they? They last for hundreds of years. They get to see... I'm imagining here that the tree can see, which is already, you know, started going off into the realm of impossibility, isn't it, really? But the amount of things that they potentially could see changing around them, and the amount of habitats that they support, you know, all the birds, all the insects. They just seem like such a stable part of our environment. Mm.
Very much the anchor point, aren't they?
Visually so many kind of as well. Around it. Yeah.
I said oak as well. So after Adrian answered the question, my answer was oak for similar reasons.
And mine was giant redwood.
Good one.
Because at my school we had a couple of those. So the school itself used to be the home of a sort of local merchant, and he collected trees, and so there were some fantastic trees, and this giant redwood was really quite mature. The scale of it was just enormous. Mm. I suppose it's the red hair as well, but and the girth. But I just had this. We had a passion for hanging out by this giant redwood when we were kids in the playground. There was something about it. It had a gravitational pull all on its own.
Trees and there's a book by what's his name? It's called The Overstory, and it's basically about the sort of the lives of trees. I mean, it's a fictional story.
We're going to sort of get up now.
Richard someone.
Okay.
I mean, it won a major prize. It's called The Overstory.
Uh-huh.
And it took me quite a long time to read it because it's quite a long book, but it has such a profound effect on me that I started looking at trees in a new light.
By Richard Powers.
That's it, Richard Powers.
Came out 5 years ago.
Mm.
I'm making a note of it now. That's
I do recommend.
And may I point out the tree on the front cover?
Yeah.
There is a giant redwood.
That's not the version I've got. Mine hasn't got that on it.
Yeah. There's just something of, again, you know, redwoods last a long, long time. So that's that element. But I think in terms of just it's got a Gothic grandeur to it. Mm-hmm. That's what I think about the redwood, that you probably could look up for 20 feet before the first branches arrive on a really mature one. So, yeah, it's something else. But the bark is amazing to touch. It really is. It's just the most amazing, slightly flaky feel to it. But, yeah. Anyway, I get very passionate about the redwood.
Well, that's telling us something about ourselves, though, isn't it? We're all choosing big grand trees that live forever. None of us want to be like little stumpy birch or something that died after 20 years.
No,
no, you're right. But there you go. I think that's it. But that's part of the creative thing, isn't it? That we're, oh, gosh, I dropped my phone again. This feeling of leaving something behind, of value and permanence. And yeah. One of the frustrations I had in my old job as a journalist was that in broadcasting, you don't even have the substance of ending up on paper as you would a newspaper or indeed a fanzine or anything like that. You know, there's no tangible thing. It goes out on air, it's stored in an archive, and that's really its only legacy. Mm-hmm. Unless it's a piece of description, and we're recording this on the day that John Motson passes away, age 77, the great commentator, who I knew. And, you know, he's got... When I sort of think of him, it's not just the sheepskin coat that everyone talks about. And
I know him.
Yeah.
I can picture him.
Now you can picture him. Right.
Didn't know who he was.
But it's the moments of magic that he was lucky enough to witness and give words to, mm-hmm. in the way that Kenneth Wolstenholme did, or Richard Dimbleby would do for a state occasion or anything like that. When you capture the moment and it gets repeated, then it takes on a certain permanence in people's minds. But in general speaking, broadcasting doesn't do that. It's in and out. It's gone. It doesn't add up to anything. And so I think that what's drawn me to writing is that feeling that it'll be there, at least in the copyright libraries, if I publish it.
I was just about to say, to fulfill your dream, you actually have to write it.
That's true. I digress. Anyway. But you know, you can see where I'm going with this. There is that feeling. I don't know if that's one of your motivations when you're writing.
Again, I don't know. I think, you know, I've got that drive to write, which I think would be there regardless.
Mm.
But yeah, no, I suppose when you think about who's going to remember me, what am I going to be remembered for? Not that in the grand scheme of things it matters. I mean, why should I be remembered? What makes me so important? And, but yeah, I think we do. We want to feel like we've left something behind, don't we? There's some, we've had some mark, and you know, I don't have children, so it feels like maybe this is the only way that I'm going to be carried through in some ways.
Yeah. Well, that's a lovely way to finish, is it not?
But I agree. You know, I like the idea of being remembered for words or art or something.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a good thing to aspire to. Anyway, where can people find you online and find out more about your work?
I'm only on Twitter. I don't have a website, I'm afraid. So on Twitter, I'm at @S_Sam at Darlington.
Fantastic. Well, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. And it's, you know, we should touch poetry a lot more often on the show.
It inspires me to write a bit more as well, because yeah. Every now and then I get poetic and
I keep forgetting you're a published poet. Susan, thanks so much for joining us.
No, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
So, listeners, what tree would you be? We'd like to know that too.
We would.
I went for giant redwood.
Giant redwood, which I had to Google because I didn't know what a giant redwood looked like. But I now know, and I'm going to look out for them on the way home.
They're not that common in this country.
Yeah, but it'll keep me quiet for 3 hours, won't it?
It will do. And that's a blessing. I'm sure the audience would agree.
You say that, but on the way down, you insisted I talk to you to keep you awake.
Yeah, I was really struggling. It was just at the start of this cold sort of settling on me, and my energy levels just dropped through the floor.
That's how the tree conversation came up in the first place.
That's right. We reached the M25, and I said, please talk to me. I'm just going, you know, I'm glazing over as I drove.
So we talked about trees.
We did. And I guess we were going past the Royal Horticultural Society at Wisby.
We were.
Yeah.
No idea.
Well, it's at Junction 10, where the A3 meets
the M25. Would know things like that.
I used to work there.
Not in the water?
No, just down the road from there, in Guildford.
Oh.
So, you know, I was a reporter, so of course I know this stuff.
Okay, fair enough.
Why have we been in Rye? We've been visiting some of the unique landscapes around here. We went to Dungeness.
We should also mention the famous person who lives in Rye.
I was getting around to that, thank you. Yeah, thanks for spoiler alert. Anyway,
it's not a spoiler. I didn't know you were going
to... We went to Dungeness. Now, we've mentioned it on the podcast before because we've had Zoe Lee Farrell and James Simpson. Joe Simpson have been on the show and they live quite relatively near here.
Yeah.
And go to Dungeness. And it is the most extraordinary landscape because it is just this gigantic pebble beach with these quite strange shack-like cabins.
And the pylons
and the nuclear power station. It's very bleak. But it was the home of Derek Jarman, the director.
Yes.
But that was quite a... made quite an impression on us. But the famous person that we've been looking, keeping our eyes peeled out for, is my great hero.
And I'm looking now. Because wouldn't it be great if he just walked around the corner right now and could come on the podcast?
Yeah, Tom Baker. I get a feeling that Tom Baker, Fourth Doctor, would love it in here.
I could see him in here.
Having said that, he now has to get around with a stick. Then it might just be... It's a little,
oh, he can still cope with a stick in here.
Well, I don't know. Anyway, he lives in it very close to Rye. And
He's been seen pottering.
And we have been this week. Before we go, we're going to have a special guest in a moment. But we wanted to express our condolences and deep concern for... actually, two friends, really. First of all, not so much deep concern, but anyway, wish you return to health, Adam Croft.
Oh, yes, Adam.
Who's been in hospital this week and is awaiting further treatment. He's had an issue with his heart, so bless you, Adam. Good luck. And the other person, and really, we feel
This, I don't know if I can compose myself long enough.
No, and this is for J.D. Kirk, or Barry Hutchison, as he is in real life, writing as J.D. Kirk, who we met at London Book Fair last year. He tweeted last night, and I must admit, it rocked my world.
Yeah, me too. I didn't sleep very well.
He forgot to put the bins out. And it's not just his bins that he does. He does his father and mother's, his mother-in-law's, and a neighbour's, elderly neighbour's bins every week. And he's let them all down.
And although we're not responsible for quite so many bins, I have been there, so I feel the pain. I have forgotten to take the bins out.
So, Barry, JD, whichever you prefer, we're with you, and may people forgive you in time for that.
And it's only 6 days till you can put the bins out again.
Absolutely. So we return to Hoback Towers this week. I'm back in the studio recording more Roman epics. I've got three more to do. I've got to get my voice back for that.
Yes, so we'll look for it on the way home.
Yeah. And you have tons and tons of stuff. Yeah, the usual stuff. We'll gloss over it. Anyway, thank you for joining us on the show. And if you wish to find out more about Hoback Books, then go to our website, www.hoback.net. And all the details of our authors, our audiobooks, our books, it's all there. And also, www.archpub.net is our new publishing services arm. If you need advice, support, technical help with writing a book or getting it produced, then come to that website and we'll lay it all out there for you, what we can offer you. But it is time now to introduce our very special guest.
Yes, we do have a special guest.
Oldest friends, and one of my dearest friends too, and I've often described her as my muse. Delighted to have Vicky Nangle with us, who has popped over for the weekend from Brighton, so not far, but it feels like a million miles away in many respects, being in Rye. And Vicky is a fabulously talented writer, but also well known in the British comedy circles as one of the great reviewers for the Brighton comedy scene, which is the epicentre of all things comic in this country, it feels like. So many great comics come from there. And so it is a great honour, as we're doing poetry, for Vicky, if you wouldn't mind passing the microphone over, to recite one of her poems. What is it?
It's a poem that's... It was for my younger self. about how you feel when you grow up and you look back, I wish I knew that. And so I wrote it, just in case any younger selves of me were reading what I was writing.
That's very appropriate for the conversation we've just been having, really. Take it away.
Dear younger me, I want you to know that that body is yours. You're not a tenant who pays rent and must keep it clean and magnolia, ready for inspection at any time. You don't need to worry that it's not acceptable as it is. You're no caretaker for another's property or future gaze. You own this home that you yourself have grown. Please, sit in that wriggly-jiggly, fun-filled meat sack. Paint it different colours. Take it flying. Let its hair grow and flow in the breeze. Start living life from the inside, growing grins and howls from the core, running wild and climbing high, with dyspraxic limbs akimbo. It doesn't matter how it looks, just enjoy its strengths, its cooks. This holy home of your psyche is your own for all of your time. It's beautiful, flawed, carefree and a warrior fierce. So don't mourn the never there but somehow failed Barbie disparity, without a thing but air behind those painted eyes of blue. It's not you. Your miracle is true.
That's beautiful. Thank you.
Thanks.
And here's an exclusive spoiler. We've invited Vicky to... we're getting married in the end of the year, and Vicky's going to recite one of her fabulous poems at that. Well, you can't say any more than that, really, because it's all a bit hush-hush, but there we go. We're looking forward to that, too. So thank you for joining us. Thank you for your company over the weekend. It's been brilliant. And it's been really nice for me, being a poorly person, being looked after by two wonderful people. So,
two wonderful, beautiful,
yes,
intelligent, witty.
Yeah, all of that. All of that. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, of course. Goes without saying. So I haven't said it. Anyway. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Hofcast Book Show. Let's, of course, not forget to mention who we're speaking to next week, Nicole Johnson.
Johnston, yes. Nicole Johnston, who is a book coach.
Which is brilliant. This is something that I'm fascinated by. But, you know, it's not dissimilar to Ajpub in a way, some of that work, I'm sure.
No, so we're going to pick her brains a little bit and find out what she does.
Yeah, absolutely. Quite a few people using the services of book coaches now to help. You know, it's not that easy to approach it. You've got a book in you, but how do you get it there?
Yeah.
That's the question. So thank you for joining us. My name's been Adrian Hobart.
It has, and my name's been Rebecca Collins. It still is.
And, well, it won't be forever.
Oh, yeah, I'll be Hobart.
You will. You will. If things go, you know, as long as we cock it up between now and December, you'll be a Hobart. Thanks for joining us, and of course, don't forget to have a wonderful and
creative
week. Bye bye.
You've been listening to the Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.